What's cooking on 95BFM? Thanks to audioculture.co.nz, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Te pātaka korihi o ngā pōro o Aotearoa.
Welcome to the BFM studio once again, Gareth. Shoot.
Sure. How's it?
It's good. Ads, mate. It's good.
We're talking about another one of your articles that you've written.
Yeah, I thought you'd bring you up to date on some new audio culture things, but also talk about one of my sort of classic articles that's come up recently.
This is probably a really hard question. How many have you written for audio culture?
A few dozen.
Right.
I don't know, quite a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, it was pretty hectic in the early years where it's like, oh, we've got to get these main people on there so it's not kind of empty. It's weird launching a website that's like meant to be the history of New Zealand music, because, you know, as soon as you launch it, everyone's going to be like, hasn't got this person.
Oh, totally. Especially in a country as small as New Zealand, you run into the people that they've missed out.
It's a movable feast as well, you know. Totally. Everyone wants to write about Flying Nun in the 60s, but you have to fill in the other gaps and stuff.
Totally.
Now, what's new on audio culture?
Well, the big one related to BFM, the story on the homepage of the audio culture at the moment is the Book of Biffin, which is a magazine that BFM did.
Biffin. We were figuring out how to say it.
Yeah.
Biffin.
This blows our mind because I had no idea that BFM had a magazine. And obviously just goes to show you how powerful BFM is and has been.
Yeah, I think it was like pre the B logo or whatever, where they were still, they put lines between the BFM and so they just called it Biffin. I mean, originally it was Radio Bosom, wasn't it? So
I was just
kind of playing with that as well. But it's an amazing magazine, and it's a great article just because it's got great visuals
The covers are great. There's mentions of Shads in here. There's all sorts of rad stuff, like heaps of epic gig posters. And if anyone wants to just follow along, you can just go to audioculture.co.nz and follow your nose to the Biffin.
It
dropped today, so have a look.
John Colley and
some of the artists, the covers are fucking wicked.
It makes really me feel good. Like BFM's not producing enough artwork at the moment.
Yeah.
That one I wouldn't mind on personally.
Need more gig posters.
Mm. They're fantastic. Was this like a weekly magazine or?
I'm not sure. I think it was monthly.
That sounds a little bit more feasible.
Well, I haven't read into that. And then there's a few things we did for Music Month, like the Music Month theme is Access All Areas, which was partly like all ages gigs. So I did a article on New Zealand bands that have got on the charts while they were still at high school. Mm-hmm. There's a high school hitmakers one in there with like Betcha Duper and Supergroove and people like that.
Yeah.
There was a big kind of weird gap because in the 60s and 70s, they'd just pluck young, good singers, like 14, 15-year-olds off the street and shove them in the studio and they could put them on these kind of variety shows and get a hit. But then in the 80s and 90s, it was just like really hard to do that. Mm-hmm. And it's funny to reflect how now, because of digital technology, you've started getting these like young people getting on the charts again.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Josh 685 or whatever can do it in his bedroom while he's still at high school, so it cuts out all that.
Pitch up that trumpet.
All that stuff in the 90s, record labels had cost so much to record.
There was a clear
albums.
Path, wasn't there?
Yeah.
And you had to be like the chosen ones, so almost.
So it'd be really hard to go that quickly from high school to the charts, but now they can do it again, including Lord, of course.
Right. A few years ago, we had Nick Atkinson from Hopetown Brown and Supergroove, and he was telling a story about how they were touring the country at the time when, you know, they were the bee's knees, and there was no one.
He was just a wee lad.
So. Yeah, there was no one on the tour, like, including like the adults, you know, that was sort of, everyone was under like 25,
And
they're doing this big tour at the time.
I mean, to get on the charts in the 90s, you had to start real young. Like they all started at like 13 or whatever. They were playing at like Java Jive and shit. And that's when the drinking age was like 20. So they must have looked ridiculous like in these bars. Trying to play the blues to start off with. Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Now, Gareth, we are specifically talking about an article that you've written about the Brunettes.
6 years ago.
Yeah, I wrote it a while ago, but just because of the ongoing career of the lead singer, Jonathan Bree, it kind of is evergreen. It comes back around again. It's kind of interesting to read that history of where he came from, since he doesn't really do interviews that much anymore. He's kind of behind a mask, of course.
A while ago, I sent a message to try and get him up here. I actually didn't realise that he sort of avoided doing press.
Yeah.
So I was like, why is he icing me out? He's never replying. But
yeah.
You can still be mad. Yeah. Totally fine.
Well, the Brunettes article kind of shows why that would be. Like, if you read that history, I mean, one reason I wanted to write it, I was involved with the label that
did the,
Little Chief Records.
Little Chief.
Yeah, and so, you know, and I saw them when, before Heather, the other lead singer of the band, joined, like I saw them when they were a four-piece, mm-hmm. just scungy indie guys and stuff. Mm. And I mean, even by that stage, he must have been 18 or whatever, but he'd already been playing since he was 12. He used to be in this band, the Plaster Saints, and he had his first song on the BFM Top 10 when he was like 14, you know, in the Plaster Saints. So he already had this kind of long, crazy history. But yeah, and it is a funny story. I mean, even just how they did their first album, because you couldn't record in a studio back then. Like we were saying, it was really expensive. And so he had this plan that he'd use cassette four-track recorders, but he wanted like 16 tracks. So what he thought is he'd use three different cassettes so he could do a clean recording of each of the 16 tracks. And then he'd like blend them all together using DAT at the end.
That's not going to work out, I don't
Well,
not
yeah. So sure enough, when he finally, he'd recorded strings, like it was like,
depending on if you've got a relatively consistent setup, but
no, when you, yeah, of course, as you predict. Yeah. When he went to put them together, they started out, the first few seconds were fine, and it was
could be rad
amazing
for a moment, and then
but the tapes were all stretched at different positions, and the tape machines were different, and
that's
stuff that
thing,
he'd recorded with, and so yeah, it just went more and more out of time, and so like a couple of years of work trying to like record this album that way went down the toilet.
I suppose you could take all those samples and put them in a computer and work with them, but what a nightmare.
Yeah, well, now you could actually. That's a funny thing he was saying the other day. Oh, I could actually go back
that.
And do them. It's like real easy with Serato and things like that to stretch stuff without changing the tempo and stuff. Mm. So, but in those days, I mean, one of the reasons he started Little Chief was Scott Mannion and their other friend Lawrence Mickelson was because Scott had Pro Tools, like, and this was 20 years ago and no one had it. And it was kind of like, oh, finally, a way to deal with 16 tracks in one place and sort of. So that's why they started Little Chief. But luckily, Neil Finn heard them as well. And so they were on EMI for that first album as well, which helped kind of launch it. But was, yeah. So I thought we'd start off by just playing one of the tracks off that first album, Moon and June stuff.
So this came from the failed tape attempts or the
No, this was the re-record.
Right.
So it could have been, but it wasn't to be.
Fantastic.
Feeling you got it all.
Fab.
The Brunettes, Moon and June stuff.
Yeah. So we're just talking about my audio culture article.
That's correct.
The Brunettes. So after that first album, the Brunettes had a big kind of stroke of luck. They spent all their money on going to the UK back when the New Zealand dollar was worth like 29p. And it was like crazy. And back when Nick Hart was the drummer from Shocking Pinks. But they went over there and they only had one show booked, which was supporting the Datsuns. I mean, the funny thing is the Brunettes came out at this time when that style of bringing back the 60s pop was not really in vogue. It was all that sort of guitar rock, The Have and D4 and Datsuns and stuff. It's this real kind of hard rock reaction to like the dance music of the 90s. So it was kind of an awkward time. But they, once they got to England, they managed to score a support slot with the postal service. Mm-hmm. Luckily, their manager, Millie Olican, was a pretty sharp kind of performer, and so she got them support there, and they managed to meet Jonathan Poneman, who ran Sub Pop, which was a label that started like Nirvana and the Shins and stuff, and so that's where they first made that connection with him. Mm-hmm. And through that they ended up supporting the Shins through New Zealand, and then the Shins said, "Oh, come on a US tour with us." And so that's really what kicked off their worldwide kind of aspirations, doing this massive tour just as the Shins were breaking.
I remember going to see the Shins play one like Friday afternoon at Real Groovy and just being like, oh my goodness, this is incredible.
Yeah, they're an amazing band. I mean, yeah, they just had such a sudden kind of burst of into popularity. Mm-hmm. I guess it was partly that movie, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah,
Something State or whatever, where they
Garden State.
Yeah, the lady's like, listen to this song, and puts the headphones on the main character and stuff. And so they kind of exploded. So it was a crazy tour for the Brunettes to be on. But of course, the Brunettes were not really ready for that. And it was hugely expensive getting all the visas and organizing it and stuff. And as we were discussing off air, you know, they were playing as like a 10, 12 piece, this kind of orchestrate at that point. So they decided they still had to get rid of a few members, but they took like 7 people with them and a sound man and stuff. It was like totally crazy. But it was a really big tour that kind of broke them. And the funny thing was, though, Sub Pop decided they wouldn't sign them for the album that was already done and that was out there. And so they signed them for the following one. Mm-hmm. And so they were touring with the Shins, but the only album they had was their second album, which was released in New Zealand by Little Chief, but also by Reverberation in Australia. So they'd go around and all the copies in the stores were through the Australian label, mm-hmm. who were just a bit more worldwide connected or whatever.
Right.
And so even Jonathan's own label, Little Chief, just couldn't get in. And it just felt really weird to be like, what? We're making all this money for this weird Australian label like that the drummer from UMI runs and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Were you playing with the band by this stage?
No, I was helping out at Little Chief. I lived above Jonathan and Scott, and so I ended up being dragged in to help out, kind of volunteer. And I played in the Ruby Sons, one of their other bands at that point. So I went overseas first with the Ruby Sons while this was kind of going on.
Mm-hmm.
But it was handy having the Sub Pop connection. Like I got a job at one point. They decided to have their sort of work getaway in the South Island, and so they brought all 25 people in the company, including like Mark Arm from Mudhoney and people like that, over, and I drove them around in vans in the South Island and stuff. It was totally bizarre. You know, we like rocked up in Christchurch and one of the guys was like, "Where can we get some cocaine around here?"
Right.
And I was just like, "Nowhere." What are you talking about? So it was pretty funny being in all these scenic kind of places with these totally tattooed Seattleites who are all like from the grunge generation sort of thing. Anyway, I thought we'd play Polyester Meets Acetate off that second Brunettes album now, because I always thought this should be kind of a hit, but because Sub Pop didn't come on board until the album after, I don't think it really did the business.
Right up.
For the first year man again, this grabs your pupil for her to feel like her. She got flattened foresight. It's a bell to a campus crush. The first year co-ed fun. Polyester acetate cuts that will never date. I looked at her tomorrow sad. Conquest in the heels, so in touch with style and grace. When all the fools in school go, I wish they would all go half pay. Instead of making plays for her. Ooh, instead of making plays for alternative press. When all the fools in school go, Chomsky's a coffee shop date, and I just wanna play for her. Ooh, I just wanna play for her. In heels, so in touch with style and grace. When all the fools in school go, I wish they would all go half naked. Instead of making plays for her. Ooh, instead of making plays for her.
Gareth Shute from Audio Culture in studio with us. We're chatting about his article from about five or six years ago about Jonathan Bree and the Brunettes.
Yep.
And some of their trials and tribulations.
Yeah.
Well, bit of a roller coaster.
Yeah, we're up to the trial and tribulation part. Yeah, I mean, after that first tour with the Shins and stuff, there were just sort of endless tours with the Brunettes trying to break overseas. And they had some just kind of unfortunate moments, like their first big video single for her Hiragami Set, like, got real good pickup on YouTube when YouTube was very early on. And it got like 300,000 views within a month, which was a lot back then.
Whoa, yeah.
And, you know, we're talking about 2007, 2008, like, it was very early days. But the weird thing was, the video is all about someone getting a hair set and doing up their hair, sort of in a 60s style. And at the end, this girl goes in and blows the girl's hair to ruin her haircut or whatever with a hair dryer. And it was just after Columbine had happened. So Sub Pop decided, oh, we're not going to promote that single. We just think it's going to be a bit too on the nose. So we're not going to push it to MTV or whatever. So on the one hand, it was just kind of blowing up online. But on the at the same time, the record labels in America were just not
not
getting
it.
Behind it.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, so they did one huge tour kind of supporting that album, and then they even did a second one, which is where I came in and ended up doing 3.5 month tour mm-hmm. with the Brunettes through like Australia, Europe, America.
What's 3.5 months like on the road with a touring band?
It's great in some ways because you're in a bar and you have a reason to interact with people. Mm-hmm. So wherever you go, you're like making friends. And mm-hmm. like we made friends, the other bands we played with, like Shout Out Louds and Bray Root, are like lovely guys. And so it was super awesome hanging out with them. I guess the downside is like for 1 week I was sick. I got like real sick. Mm-hmm. And for that tour, like Jonathan Bree, the leader of the band, he was like, oh, you can join, but I really need someone to play trumpet and I need someone to play saxophone. That's who we're looking to replace. So within 2 months leading up to the tour, I learned trumpet and Princess Chelsea learned saxophone so we can play on this tour. So we had this like super high sort of learning curve to like play these instruments. So we both just hated them by the end. Like I could, yeah, it was pretty funny. And lugging them around as well, like I had a trombone, a valve trombone I played to and stuff. But when I got sick for a week, playing trumpet is the worst when you're sick.
Need your breath.
Yeah, you're trying to breathe. And then you're like blowing away this precious air, you know. We'd be doing these like crazy, like we did this crazy festival in like Belgium. And I just remember just felt like my whole body was just sweating away into the stage and stuff. It's funny, we saw like Matt Eccles from Betch Duper, his band Dust Pop was the headliner there. Mm-hmm. Like they were a massive Belgian band. It's so funny that this guy, New Zealand guy, had this weird career overseas where he's like huge in like one or two countries but nowhere else. But anyway, yeah, the Brunettes kind of went on from there. I mean, when I was in the band, I also saw a painful moment, which was they had a song called B-A-B-Y that was put on this.
That was on Rotate on BFM, I'm sure.
Yeah, probably. And it was on this Hollyoaks ad in the UK. And it was a 30-second long ad. And so it was quite massive. Everyone mm-hmm. saw this ad. And then but because Sub Pop were in America, they couldn't see this going on. They didn't want to spend more money on publicizing this song. Mm-hmm. So you had this terrible situation where we go and play these big gigs like Shepherd's Bush Empire with Broken Social Scene or whatever. And when we played the song, everyone in the audience was so excited. Oh my God, that song, you're that band. And it was like, oh great, so you like this song, but you have no idea who plays it or like where you're going to buy it or whatever. It's totally wasted. Like there's no one to draw the dots. So yeah, it was very kind of painful time in the Brunettes in those days. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I thought we'd play here Her Hairy Gami Set. It's one of the songs, hits that could have been, indie hits that could have been.
Yeah. Wait, is this the Hollyoaks track?
No, this is the YouTube one.
Thank you.
That brunettes is definitely sounding a lot more Jonathan Bree.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot more kind of rhythmic drums and
a bit more vibe.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing he struggled with in the early brunettes days,
I want to say, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, people kind of talked about twee and stuff and thought brunettes was kind of quite bubblegum, but there was always kind of a darker element, and that came out more and more as it went along. And so I think it was a lot easier for him later on to bring that out in the Jonathan Bree stuff. But I mean, the Brunettes went on after that sort of third album and did another album, but that was when they really struck like bad luck. Like they were ready for a big last tour and went to New York, spent all their money going to New York, and they were going to practice up the band there and stuff. And they signed a new manager who was like really excited, and he said, ditch your touring agent, ditch your other management and publicist and everything. And then he just like had a total mental breakdown just as they arrived. And so they just were stuck in New York, like burning money.
Don't have a tour to go on or anything.
No. So he was going to organize it all after they were going to practice in New York, because Heather lived in New York by that stage. Mm. And in fact, it was going to be this, you know, it was a great band at that time because Jonathan Chelsea were together in it, and then Heather's partner Andrew Thompson was in the band as well, mm-hmm. playing bass, and then the drummer John Parker had actually been in the band for a long time. It wasn't that kind of crazy turnover, so I was like, this is gonna be great. Oh no, it's gonna be terrible. And so they luckily, because we toured with Beirut back when I was in the band, we toured with Beirut, and their manager's a really lovely guy, Ben Goldberg. So he was like, okay, I'll manage you. I'll sort something out. I'll get my assistant, who happened to be Sharon Van Etten, to organize a tour for you. So she organized a tour for them, and they did a last tour with that lineup, but they wasted a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. And
got burnt out on the industry.
Yeah. I mean, it was a weird kind of, it did kind of show the way forward though, because Jonathan was doing a lot of the recording for that album in the tour van and stuff. He worked out how to do digital stuff so it sounds live a lot more, and so it did kind of point the way forward. And I mean, it did actually generate their biggest hit if you look at Spotify, because weirdly one of the songs off it, Red Roller Skates, was used in the PlayStation game NBA 2K11 or whatever. So it was this massive game that sold 6 million copies or something.
When would that play? Like in the game or in like the...
When does that fit in? Weirdest song to have in an NBA game. Like I don't...
It must be so
imagine,
fun creating playlists for those random things. There.
Yeah. So he had this weird kind of... Brunettes did have this weird afterlife. I mean, the band was already kind of almost over by that stage. They did come back and they played a big show at the King's Arms, which was their final goodbye. But sadly... the honest truth is that they still owe money, and so they actually had to play one more industry gig after that, which was like a shitty sort of advertising company type thing at Cassette 9. So their last gig was actually just this depressing gig where everyone's talking and no one was paying attention. So that was kind of like, oh yeah, that's why we're quitting. And that paid off their debts.
That's no reflection on Cassette 9, by the way.
No.
More the people at the...
That was just a certain night.
Yeah, fair enough.
Now you've queued up a Jonathan Bree song.
We're in the Jonathan Bree section of this brunette journey.
So cool, which is an epic tune.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I mean, Jonathan didn't even really want to do music after that, and it was really Chelsea who kind of encouraged him. And his first album, solo as Jonathan Bree, for the music video, he just shot himself watching his laptop and put the entire album as a soundtrack and just uploaded it to YouTube and stuff. So it was all kind of like just putting the music out and not caring, and sort of stopped doing interviews and all the things he found painful. But he did, he did make the music video and, you know, did the guitar solo and stuff on Princess Chelsea's song Cigarette Duet, which was like, her song that went amazingly viral on YouTube.
56 million views or something.
Yeah, it's got...
crazy.
Yeah, it's on 60 million views, I think, now on YouTube. And
there's a couple of BFM videos on our YouTube channel, and those are the massivest ones.
Yeah.
people just, there's a lot of Euros out there wanting to watch a bit of Princess Jazzy, turns
out. Yeah, so John, I mean, John, you can see Jonathan's kind of aesthetic, you know, like he kind of directed that video, which they just kind of shot at her parents' house. So it's kind of crazy. It did kind of point a path forward for him. I mean, just briefly while we're on the subject, the weird thing with Princess Chelsea is she's blown up on TikTok recently as well. She was used in a video by the wife of Tommy Lee from Motley Crue.
Oh, wow.
And so that video, that TikTok has like 13 million views, and then that led to her song being used in like 50,000 TikTok videos. And now
that's so out of, we had her in today. I had no idea about that.
Yeah,
it's so just, it's such fun kind of mystical music that she makes. So I can see it
so
just
the
being
cigarette duet YouTube videos actually being viewed per day just as much as when it was very first released, which is like 50,000 views per day.
That's frightening
at the moment. So it's insane. And she's playing Saturday at Whammy Bar.
That's right.
So
good luck.
If you're in Auckland, see someone who's way more famous overseas than they are here.
The interesting thing is, if you go to her any of her social medias or whatever, and she's saying, look, I'm playing this show, and it's just people overseas going, fucking, I want to go, I can't go.
Yeah, went to the live stream. Oh, what Wednesday are you
stream.
In are you in the future, you're a day ahead. Oh my god, what time of day is this going to be in Australia?
The thing is, you'll probably be able to see her at Whammy Bar with 100 people.
Yeah, it's crazy. And well-curated situation as well with Chabs and Milky.
Yeah, with like Liao, who's awesome, and Vincent HL, which would be cool. But back to Jonathan Bree, I mean, that cigarette duet video kind of showed Jonathan how he had a great eye for music videos, and so he kind of worked over his music videos towards this sort of masked persona. Mm-hmm. He actually first did it in this video, Weird Hardcore, which got a bit of view, but obviously the next song we're going to play, You're So Cool, the one where it just went crazy and now has like 22 million views itself and totally launched his career overseas. So
beautiful video, beautiful song.
So check out. Thank you.
find solace in the privilege to pursue. Most people are crushed into servitude.
Jonathan Bree, You're So Cool. That is a huge tune.
Yeah.
Selected by Gareth Shute from Audio Culture.
We have been running down the history of the brunettes as per Gareth's article on Audio Culture. Go ahead and have a squiz.
It is a fascinating article to read. I read it a few weeks ago and I was like, wow. Such an interesting story behind both the brunettes and Jonathan Bree.
Texter's really enjoying the inside scoop of the amazing band and artist. There you go. Thanks very much.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, Jonathan Bree's having such a big career. It is funny even seeing people kind of ripping or not ripping him off. Like we, even the other day we saw this video that's come up with the masked band behind this guy with all the kind of 60s colours. And it's
a while ago, Saint Vincent that did something?
Yeah,
a while
Saint
ago?
Vincent.
It was too close to be comfortable, eh?
I saw that and it was weird, with the like drummer wing, same kind of headphones and stuff. I mean, some of my friends were like, you're just joking, like that it's too similar, like Pink Floyd and stuff, like maybe they got it from somewhere else. But there's this band I saw the other day who do the song Medicine called Dayglow, and it's just such close. It's like the band are even in the same kind of little stand behind the singer and stuff, and
like
it's
a
so 60s funny.
Talk show kind of thing. Oh, it's like Top of the Pops almost, I guess you'd say, right?
You can sort of see how influential it's been in that sense. Mm. I mean, the problem is that just before that song blew up, he'd shot a music video where he showed his face, and so we got NZ on Ear funding, and we have that, and it was on the last album, the song No Reminders, but it's like, I can't really use the video with his face now. He's going to have to, like, be behind the mask. Like, when are we going to use this video? Spend so much effort making it. Oh, well. But one day, I guess, maybe for some sort of greatest hits or something. But yeah, I mean, Jonathan Bree's success goes on, and it's a much more kind of comfortable success than the brunettes. You can follow now where you're big through digital means or whatever. Like when we can look on YouTube and see what countries he's big in. It is funny seeing New Zealand at like number 50th,
right?
In terms of where he's popular.
Well, it's not a per capita, though.
No, it's not a per capita. That's true. Maybe if we add it up, I mean, America's always at the top. But it's funny seeing countries like Mexico and then just thinking, oh shit, how are we going to get him to Mexico? Like, what sort of visas do we need? Like,
get to on the ground and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean,
John and I were saying it was trippy to see Jonathan Bree on a levitation bill a while ago, and then you think about it and you're like, oh yeah, that fucking, it totally fits. It's just that kind of future retro vibe, you know, like really rad.
Yeah, and he's working on a new album now. Unfortunately, he's not.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, the one downside is Jonathan Bree didn't really keep the home fires burning because he's been overseas touring so much, so lockdown was a total pain. And Little Chief really does just do Chelsea and Jonathan and Scott Mannion now, because we couldn't really foster those other artists. So, you know, Sheepdog and Wolf's gone off on his own, and Voom re-released their album with Flying Nun and stuff. So it's good to see those artists still going on, even though we were probably a really frustrating label to work with at different times, and we had way too many things going on for this tiny label.
Gareth, thanks so much for sharing this article. It's obviously close to your heart that you're right up in, and weird to talk about, but thanks so much.
Yeah, it's funny to talk about a band that you're in. Yeah, but yeah, I thought if no one else did. But check out on Audio Culture, there's an article I did on Lawrence Arabia on there, and Gary Steele did one on Little Chief Records and stuff. Okay. So there's a lot of kind of cool stuff from this new millennium to check out, and thanks for having me.
Audio Culture, awesome. Rolling. Hey, we're going to go out on one more Jonathan Breed tune.
Waiting on the Moment. Why have you lined this one up?
Oh, I just think this is another one that is kind of could be a hit. We really struggle trying to get Jonathan Breed stuff on Spotify playlists, like because we release stuff through Little Chief in New Zealand, it goes through the Australian Spotify playlist makers, right. And the stuff is just like a little bit too, the drums are a bit too jerky or like rhythmic, and it's kind of peculiar and creepy, and so
algorithm does not compute.
Yeah, but Waiting for the Moment is one that they really picked up and backed, and so it's over its various iterations, it's getting near a million itself and doing quite well, so it's a cool track, and he's got a new album probably coming end of this year, early next year. So.
Oh, heck. Well, nice if one. You know anything before everyone else, let us know.
Yeah, it'll be... I'll let you guys know soon.
Kia ora, mate. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
What's cooking on 95BFM? Thanks to audioculture.co.nz, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Te pātaka korihi o ngā pōro o Aotearoa.